For the week of October 8th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 383, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. I could have been at the Betty Ford Clinic, but who wants to make jokes on a day like this?
Wait, why would you have been at the Betty Ford Clinic?
Well, somebody needs to go into rehab and therapy and get something dealt with, don't they?
Oh my goodness. Okay, yes. I think for anybody following the entertainment news, I think we all know what you're referring to.
That's right. Harvey Weinstein.
That's right. In fact, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll discuss what everyone else is discussing, the fall from grace of movie mogul Harvey Weinstein, the mass exodus of board members from his studio, his brother and business partner Bob Weinstein stepping up, and what that means for the long-term survival of one of Hollywood's best-known indie labels, the Weinstein Company. That comes up during Inside Baseball. During our book filter segment, Michael will tell us about a sci-fi novel in which teenage girls get empowered, as in literally powered, and the rest of society pretty much freaks out. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. Though first, Michael, I'm wondering, do we need to fill anybody in on what the Betty Ford Clinic is for any of our international listeners?
No.
Okay.
All right, we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it, including you, our listeners. And the number one movie around the world is Blade Runner 2049. $82 million on its opening weekend. Most countries around the world, it's opened up in 64 territories, though it still has yet to open in China, Japan, or Korea. And the people behind this movie are really hoping that China, Japan, and Korea love it.
Why is that?
Because the movie opened at $81 million around the world, and it fell far short of expectations in North America. I mean, we're used to seeing tracking being off sometimes, and it was dramatically off. But was it off, or was it just that word of mouth became poisonous? Before the weekend happened, a few days leading up to it, we're looking at $45 to $50 million in North America. It ended up at $32 million, $31.5 million to be exact. The studio, however, says, hey, we had a nice uptick on Saturday. We feel like word of mouth is good. The movie has a long running time, and we feel like we're in for a long haul with good legs for a movie that adults will turn out to. So we're very, you know, we wish it had done bigger, but we're happy, and it's a long game that we're playing here. And of course, that's what we do here. We say, wait till all the money is in. You know, don't jump over the open. It doesn't matter what it makes on opening weekend. It matters what it makes when all is said and done. But what do the prospects look like?
Well, I think part of the problem is that you have, I asked if you'd seen the film, and you said, no, I don't have, like, you know, 4.5 hours to devote to this, or, you know,
it's 2 hours and 43 minutes.
Yeah. It's a commitment. It's a 3 hour commitment. In the US, you had a lot of sporting events this weekend that really pulled people away from movie theaters. I didn't go, not because of sporting events, just because, you know, I did not have the time.
Well, I didn't go because most of the reviews weren't great, but I will see it in the theater because I feel like there's no reason to see it on DVD and Blu-ray. I don't care what your home system is like. If there's any enjoyment to be had from this movie, it's probably from seeing the spectacle on a big screen. It sounds like technically it's pretty impressive. The big problem for this movie to me is that it costs $150 million to make.
Yes.
I mean, the original Blade Runner is an incredibly influential film. I like it a lot. It grossed $33 million worldwide. This is not some big, heavy-hitting franchise. And, you know, if it had made a lot of money, we'd say, oh, weren't they smart? But, you know, it seemed like an odd movie to make a sequel to after all these years. We questioned that from the start. And to make it at this price point is also very questionable because it's a lot of damn money. They're going to have to make $450 million just for us to feel like they're, you know, having a hit on their hands. And that's going to be a bit of a long haul. We'll see what word of mouth is like next weekend. I don't think the running time is a problem as such. At least it feels like an event, something worth going to the movies. That's not keeping me away. I made a joke about it, but, you know, at least you're getting dollar for your value.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing it. I saw 30 minutes of it at Expo Cine in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and I didn't realize that what I was seeing was like 1/100th of the movie at the time, but it looked amazing, and I am really looking forward to seeing it.
Now, the budget for the movie we're reporting as $150 million, but I've also seen $190 million. It's funny how the budgets fluctuate once they get a sense of the movie. Do they want to make it seem like a big movie, or suddenly if it opens soft, do they want to downplay how much it costs to make? But we'll have to see where that ends up. And number two around the world is Never Say Die. That's the body swapping comedy from China. And then somebody described it as a sports comedy. And I'm like, sports comedy? And I looked up closer and it turns out the two people who swap bodies are a male UFC boxer and a female reporter who exposes his bribes, the bribes that he was taking, I guess, to throw matches. So that's the couple at the heart of this film. I didn't know that. So it is a body swapping sports comedy. It grossed another $66 million on the weekend, $222 million worldwide. That one is doing great. And it's only in four territories.
Well, and one of them being China, where it actually topped Blade Runner.
Yes, though I do take issue with some of the headlines that say Never Say Die beats Blade Runner in the international market. I'm like, well, yes, if you take out Blade Runner's biggest market, just as if you took out Never Say Die's biggest market, Blade Runner would top it. I think worldwide box office is what matters. That's what we talk about. And even comparing two movies is silly because, as you say, Never Say Die is only in four territories, whereas Blade Runner 2049 is in 64. So it's really apples versus oranges when you're looking at the international market. How wide released are they? You know, where are they going to end up? That's all that matters. The fact that one is slightly above the other, if you don't count the biggest territory for Blade Runner, you know. Whatever. You know, Blade Runner made $50 million overseas and $32 million in North America. $50 million is a perfectly fine, okay start. And number three around the world is Kingsman, The Golden Circle. Another $33 million on the weekend, $250 million worldwide. So that's getting close to the $300 million, which will triple its estimated budget. So that will be securely in the hit category. And number four is It, the horror film based on the Stephen King novel. Another $30 million for that movie. It passes the $600 million mark. At number five is Chasing the Dragon, another Chinese film. This is the Andy Lau gangster flick, $17 million on the weekend. That's at $60 million worldwide. So, you know, you can see the divide between that and Never Say Die. Never Say Die is really tearing it up around the world, $220 million. It's already quadruple what Chasing the Dragon is making. And number six is The Foreigner, the Jackie Chan English language film. That's opening up here in the U.S. briefly. $17 million on the weekend, $67 million worldwide. And that one, unlike those other two, should have relatively high prospects in North America. I don't know how it'll do. They're like, The Legend Returns. But, you know, it's English language. It's Jackie Chan and Pierce Brosnan. So that's got a fighting chance of making real money in North America.
Well, you know, actually, Jim Amos over on Celluloid Junkie pointed out the last live-action film that we saw Jackie Chan in was in 2010. He hasn't started a movie in 7 years.
Well, that's why they said The Legend Returns. He's still a big name, right, isn't he?
Yes, absolutely.
And number seven is The Fortress. It grossed $14 million on its opening weekend. This is a Korean historical drama. It's about, in the 1600s, I think, China attacks. The Korean king and his court take refuge in a mountain fortress, obviously, as in the title, and they debate whether to capitulate or fight. So one faction says, we have to make peace with China, and the other faction says, fight, the honor of Korea. I'm guessing the latter one wins. And number eight is The Mountain Between Us, the Idris Elba and Kate Winslet romantic drama, $13 million on its opening weekend. The Lego Ninjago movie, another $13 million for that flick. That's at just about $80 million. That's based, of course, on toys, which turned into an unexpected franchise in video games and short films. And does it have a TV? The Lego Ninjago TV series and now movies? You never know what's going to become a hit property. That's certainly the case for My Little Pony, a toy that began in 1981, I think, became a huge success, fizzled out, brought back, didn't work, brought back again, worked like gangbusters. So now it's back in action. This is the second feature film spinoff from the My Little Pony franchise. It grossed $12 million on its opening weekend, 50 territories it played in. We don't really know what this movie cost, but a pretty unreliable source says that it cost $65 million. That's not a ton of money for an animated film, but it's certainly not bargain basement. No matter what it is, it's probably cost too much.
You know, again, if you're not reading Jim Amos over at Celluloid Junkie, you really should. I mean, his quips and his snark is very good when it comes to reporting box office and predicting box office each week. He pointed out a review from Christy Lemire from RogerEbert.com. He said that she summed up the film by, and this is a quote, she said, imagine eating a giant bag of Skittles, then throwing it all up in a fit of sugar-induced nausea, and you'll have some idea of what it feels like to sit through My Little Pony the movie.
But that's him quoting somebody else reviewing the movie?
Yes. Well, I'm just pointing out that he brought it to my attention.
I see. And does he, you feel like he is ahead of other people's expectations? Was he saying earlier that the reports for Blade Runner, for example, were way off and that it wasn't going to make nearly what they said? Or what's an example of how he's an outlier and smarter than your average bear?
He is a long-term distribution executive who's now kind of on his own. Used to work for Sony for years, and he kind of knows the tracking and how to read the tracking. His verdict for Blade Runner was actually a little off. That let's say it does barely get there and do $53 million, which for those of you scoring at home is 8.6 what the original opened to. So actually, no, he is saying it's not going to reach the $50 million mark.
Yeah, but 30 million is way lower than that.
Yeah.
But okay. But worth checking out. So you're saying he said that this is the first English language movie in all those years that we've seen Jackie Chan in?
Yes. No. Right, okay. Because
he's had live action Asian films, of course.
Yes.
I mean, earlier this year he had Kung Fu Yoga. So, you know, it's not like he went away. He just isn't as big an English language star as he used to be.
Correct. Yes.
All right, moving along, number 11 is City of Rock, the Chinese comedy, $12 million on the weekend, $40 million worldwide. Tom Cruise's American Made is just about to hit the $100 million mark. Here's a new movie. It's a Korean crime thriller, and it's called Crime City. It was really hard for me to find out what this movie was about because it's sort of a vague title, and I didn't know what country it was from or anything about it. And you try to look up crime and city, and you get a lot of stuff.
Well, and also on IMDb, if you look up the actor's credits and the director's credits, they're not, you know, it's not even listed in their resume.
Oh, really?
Good yes. Heavens.
Well, it might be under another name now.
No, I thought the same thing, and it's not even listed under another name.
Well, you know, if somebody in Korea doesn't input the movie title, they're not going to know it exists yet, are they?
No.
You know, there's so many movies all over the world. I'm sure there's lots of films from India that slip through the cracks as well. But it's a crime thriller. It's based on the true story of a Chinese-Korean crime syndicate. And the tough-as-nails cop, sort of an Untouchables-like group, I think, is the idea, who tries to bring them down. And it stars Ma Dong-seok, and it grossed just about $10 million on the weekend. Another Chinese film below that, Sky Hunter, $9 million in the weekend, $36 million worldwide. Judi Dench's Victoria and Abdul went a little wider, $7 million on the weekend. That's at $30 million worldwide. We don't really know what that cost, but that's pretty good for an art house film. Moving down, looking for something new. Oh, here we go. L'essence de la fête. It's a French comedy about putting on a wedding in an 18th century castle. It's a modern film, but it stars Jean-Pierre Bacri. In the U.S., it's going to be called C'est la vie, because I guess we can't handle, you know, I guess the original title means something like the meaning of the party or what the party's about or something like that. But we've all heard C'est la vie, so that's what they're calling it. That made $4.5 million opening up in France, so that's a pretty good strong opening for a adult, you know, comedy. I assume the budget wasn't that big. And scrolling down, another new movie, the Met Opera had a live production of Norma. That played in theaters around the world. I'm going to see this production on Wednesday, and it grossed $2.7 million worldwide.
Isn't that the opener for this year's season at the Met?
It was, yes.
Yes, yeah. Well, you also saw something over the weekend that I wanted to find out about. Didn't you see The Honeymooners on Broadway? The Honeymooners musical, is it?
It's not on Broadway. It's playing at the Paper Mill Playhouse. They certainly have Broadway in their sights. It was not a good show. The four actors were really good, though. They actually really embodied the characters really well. They weren't doing an imitation of the stars. They weren't doing spoofy or broad. They felt like actual real characters, and they were quite good. So it's a shame that the book and the score let them down.
Did anybody say To the Moon, Alice?
Oh, of course. No, they did. They touched on all the things, but again, rooted pretty well in character. What they did was they toned down the sort of tirades and the, you know, in each episode he would like scream at Norton or, you know, or he'd yell at Alice for not believing in him. I mean, and he'd threaten to hit her. But here that was all slightly softened down. They didn't get rid of that, but they just didn't have him go on rants every 5 minutes because that would get exhausting. So they didn't lose the flavor of the character, but they made him a little more realistic and a little less over the top so that it would play well over a 2.5 hour musical production.
Okay, so I guess something to look forward to.
Yeah, I don't recommend it as it is, but if they follow all my notes, they could turn it into a good show. But first, they got to write a bunch of new songs. Here's a question for you, though. The Meyerowitz Stories, New and Selected, opens Friday, October 13th here in New York. That's a movie I think you saw in Cannes.
Yes, it is.
Right. It opens at Lincoln Plaza. and IFC. In LA, it opens at the Landmark and the Lamley NoHo, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes. Yes.
The Lamley. And yeah. On Netflix around the world.
Correct.
So I'm interested that it's not, usually I thought iPick was the only place that would show a movie that was opening up on Netflix as well. But these art houses have said, you know, this is what we live in. So it's going to be available on Netflix, but they're willing to show it day and date in their movie theaters. Is that a new breakthrough?
No,
I mean, I know it's an art house film. We've seen that for documentaries and small movies. This is a slightly bigger movie given the names of the stars involved.
Right. But not only the names of the stars, but who is the director and writer? Noah Baumbach.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Noah Baumbach, right? So basically, you've got some serious indie cred there, and you're talking about some indie art houses in both
major cities.
Major cities, New York and LA. iPick probably doesn't want it because it's not a big film, and you have...
iPick plays art house movies.
Right. No, I realize that. But it's only those four or five cinemas, and it probably won't go beyond that.
Right. I was just interested that they were willing to take it. You know, I thought Netflix had to do a deal with iPix because they were like, no, we won't show the movie if you're going to show it day and date in on Netflix, even with these art house movies at that level of a film. You know, it's a pretty, you know, high profile names, Adam Sandler and who else is in it?
Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah. You know, it's a bigger than your average bear. Like, it just seems like it was an interesting twist. So it's nothing unusual. We've known for a long time, art house movies, documentaries, small films, they're not going to play 3,000 screens. And so it makes sense that they'd be available day and date or even earlier on demand online. That's okay. But, you know, big studios are trying to hold the line. The Meyerowitz story seemed like it was a little more on the bubble in terms of what the budget probably was and the high profile of the movie. So now they're opening up in a movie theater. Does this mean that they have a better shot of getting, you know, Oscar hopeful? Will it seem more legitimate?
I think ultimately it's going to matter whether people see it or not and whether it's a good movie.
Well, you saw it. Did you think it was a good movie? I wonder what the budget was. I mean, it's Emma Thompson, Dustin Hoffman, Ben Stiller, Adam Sandler, you know.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a movie that is more forgettable than anything. I mean, it's not like like a movie where I went, oh, my God, that was amazing. Like The Florida Project, which is out now in theaters and in limited release, or, you know, it's an art house film, so it's not necessarily going to go wide. That movie was memorable. That was a movie that you will not forget anytime soon. The Meyerowitz stories, I vaguely remember a few things from it, from Cannes, and, you know, it's an okay movie. It's not great. It's not horrible, but nothing where I left going, oh, my God, you've got to go see that movie.
Okay. Well, I'm sure The Florida Project will be remembered by critics at the end of the year. I doubt it'll be an Oscar contender. It'd be cool if the little girl made a run for it.
That would be, actually. Did you see the film?
Oh, yeah. I liked it a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good movie.
Yeah. I feel like it proves that Tangerine, an earlier feature by this director, was not a fluke.
Sean Baker is the name of the director. Yeah.
Yeah. And Luc Besson has a new movie. I'm sure he's hoping for Oscar hopeful contention from every movie he makes. He just announced a new film, Anna, with Helen Mirren and Luke Evans. And given the track record of Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets or whatever, I think he's probably glad.
Yeah. Well, here's my question. Somebody's letting him make another movie?
I'm making movies, people. You can't stop me. It's an action film and no budget was announced.
Okay, well, it better be small given his last film.
Well, most of his movies are, so they were smaller budgets, 40-50. So wouldn't you give him $50 million to make an action film?
Yes, I would.
He has a good track record.
Yes.
Commercially, obviously.
Yes. Ironically, now I know you're going to kill me for this, Michael. Ironically, Jim Amos, back at Celluloid Junkie, I know you're going to kill me. He actually had a reference to The Professional, a Luc Besson film, in this week's box office column. I thought, wow, he's pulling stuff out of, like, I was really shocked.
Is it American Assassin, or what was he linking it to?
You know what? I'd have to go back and look. But I remember thinking, wow, that's a unique reference because I got it because that's, you know, one of my, you know, favorite films. And even brought up the name of the character, Leon. And I remember thinking, wow, okay. He said here in The Foreigner, he says, side note, does anyone else watch the trailer and get a Professional / Leon feeling from it? I half expect Brosnan to turn around and scream, "Everyone," which is the line that Gary Oldman uses in The Professional. And I thought, wow, that I don't know whether that's an obscure reference because I love the movie so much.
Well, I don't like the movie, but Leon, of course, was its name, its title internationally.
That's why.
It was known as The Professional in North America, but it was known as Leon overseas. So it's not so much a character call out as like the name of the movie that a lot of people in most other countries would recognize. Because we have a lot of people who listen to us in Australia, South Korea, Japan, and we love hearing from you. If they want to reach out to us and say, hey, I like Leon too, how do they reach us?
Well, they can write to us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. You can find us at facebook.com/showbizsandbox. And, you know, we post stuff to, at least I post stuff to my personal Google Plus account, although it's kind
That's
of a little
adorable.
Bit, yeah, it's a little bit harder to find. And but I will say we do have a listener response from one of my posts on Google Plus, which we will be reading in our listener email section.
Sweet. I didn't see that coming. And I also didn't see the Nobel Prize going to Kazuo Ishiguro.
Oh, yes. Neither did I think a lot of people did not know that that was going to happen.
Well, I knew it was coming on Thursday. He's always been mentioned on the short list of people. As one person said, it's kind of fun because last year they gave it to Bob Dylan, and this year they gave it to one of Bob Dylan's biggest fans. Because Ishiguro is a big fan of Dylan and the Beatles and others, and he's written songs for a jazz singer, so he's got a strong connection to pop music. But he is, of course, being recognized by the Nobel Committee for novels like Remains of the Day, Never Let Me Go, An Artist of the Floating World. Well admired by other writers. I've only read Remains of the Day, actually, so I don't know much about his career, but I do know his most recent book, The Buried Giant, was sort of a fantasy and quite poorly reviewed, so it's got to be nice to come off one of his least well-received books to have the Nobel Prize pop up.
Yes, and I'm sure he will actually show up to give his Nobel Prize speech, unlike some people we know, Mr. Dylan. Okay, so, you know, certainly, The Buried Giant may not have made Book Filter's, you know, top of the week or month list, but what is making Book Filter's top of the week or month or even year list this week? Every week you show up here with a selection from Book Filter that may or may not be right for Hollywood to adapt into a film or television show. What is it this week?
This week, it's a novel by Naomi Alderman. They call it speculative fiction because they don't want to call it science fiction because then it's not literary. You know, they want to call it magic realism instead of fantasy or speculative fiction or dystopian fiction. You know what? Margaret Atwood has written sci-fi. Naomi Alderman has written sci-fi, or maybe even fantasy is the way to think about it. This is a book about our world. And suddenly, for some mysterious reason, something happens and teenage girls everywhere become immensely strong. They develop the ability to cause massive pain or even death to other people. And instead of welcoming them as Buffy-like heroes, the world pretty much freaks out. Like, what would happen if teenage girls became really, really powerful? It's not good. And not because of them, but because of how everyone else reacts. So it's a fascinating novel, great reviews. It's got a blurb from Margaret Atwood right on the cover, and it just seems ripe for development.
And is it good for teenagers or young adults? Or does...
Well, I there's no reason any 15, I would let any 15, 16, 17-year-old read anything they want, personally. So I'm maybe not a good judge of that. It's certainly not, you know, I don't know what to say. Would a 15-year-old read The Handmaid's Tale? Absolutely. Go right ahead, as far as I'm concerned.
What about an 11-year-old or a 13-year-old?
I don't know about an 11-year-old. It's probably too, you know, sophisticated for them. It ain't Harry Potter.
Okay.
This is not, you know, this is not written for a middle grade level.
Okay, well, then you've just answered my question.
Any book that my kid is interested in reading, you want to read Lolita? Knock yourself out. But that's the kind of parent I am not. I'm much more concerned about sex and violence in a film, you know. And again, I'd rather have kids watching something more sophisticated and good than watching Pablum. But there's a lot of sophisticated good stuff from classic Hollywood that is above their head and sort of is leading them forward in a sense of sophistication and intelligence. And they know something's going on, but they're not quite sure, but they can follow it and enjoy it. And I'd rather have them reaching for that rather than just watching My Little Pony. I mean, nobody should want their kid to watch My Little Pony. So, but I'm far less worried when it's a novel. I just don't find novels disturbing or upsetting. Either it's good or it's bad. If it's a good book, let them be exposed to it.
Now, just to give you some sense of how kryptonite the G rating is for movies.
Oh, right. Yeah.
My Little Pony, rated PG.
Oh my God, that is so ridiculous. That is awful.
Yeah, just because, you know, oh, it's G. Oh, it's only for 6-year-olds.
Well, you know what? That's a, it's in the movie did so poorly. I guess it's a big whoop, whatever its rating may be.
Oh, wait. Whoa. Okay. Well, if that's the case, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines and entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Comic-Con took place in New York City last weekend. Did you go, Michael?
I went by, but I did not go in.
Okay, well, it's a chance for studios to promote upcoming TV shows and movies, offer up trailers, and sometimes screen entire films, and once in a while talk about comic books. One panel was canceled after the Vegas shooting because it was felt the Punisher TV series had a revenge shooting plot too close to home. More interesting was how Marvel completely backed out of another planned event and longtime partnership. It was working with the defense industry behemoth Northrop Grumman to promote STEM education. That's science, technology. I don't know what the E stands for. Maybe education.
Engineering.
Engineering and math. Marvel got to promote the importance of science and math classes, and Northrop Grumman got to link its business to ever-increasing defense spending with the hip, cool world of Marvel. When news of what they were actually planning leaked, blowback from fans and even creators of Marvel Comics were dismayed and vocal. Marvel soon canceled the event and even the entire partnership. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I guess if you don't know what STEM stands for, you probably haven't taken engineering or math or science or tech.
Nope, in my world, 2 + 2 does equal 5.5.
Yeah, this was a big mess. Hey, kids, the defense industry is cool, just like Iron Man, except, of course, people actually die.
Yes.
You know, they suddenly realized, oh, gee, maybe we shouldn't be partnering fun, lovable defense industry, you know, companies. Good Lord. Hilariously enough, though, they did create a promotional comic that they do with other partners, that they create one-off things that they create to promote a partnership or idea, special, unique comic books featuring heroes. And they did that for these people, and they were going to hand them out or do whatever with them. But now they've disappeared, turning them into a valuable collectible. So it was about the comics after all.
And, of course, those comics will be available at next year's New York Comic-Con at an increased price. Lincoln Center, there in New York City, it's calling a timeout on plans to gut and renovate the David Geffen Hall, which
Where I just was watching Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back screened live with the New York Philharmonic doing the score, and it was a blast.
No pun intended. See a blast because it's The Empire Strikes Back and Blaster. It's
okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, I always knew it when I was growing up as Avery Fisher Hall. Okay, that's how I knew it. Geffen, David Geffen, that is, he pledged $100 million to the project and was bummed it has stalled, saying it's embarrassing that New York City couldn't pony up the rest of the $500 million needed. Lincoln Center says raising the money wasn't really the problem, but finding out that the project would take at least 3 years rather than 2 was a stumbling block. Now they're trying to decide if they should shoot for something less radical and less time-consuming. Similarly, the Metropolitan Museum of Art is delaying a $600 million expansion wing for contemporary art, and a dumb plan to create an island for cultural events dreamt up by Barry Diller has fallen apart completely. Are all of these cultural projects in New York City falling apart a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. It seems like a pause. I think the island plan was stupid to begin with. It was like, oh, we're going to create an island. It'll be a great event for arts, but, you know, most people can't go on it ever. You know, we'll basically have it for private events, you know, when we want to. So, yeah, no thanks. The Metropolitan Museum of Art. There are so many other places with wings devoted to contemporary art. I'm not quite sure, but you know, they've got a lot of stuff and they want to display it. I'm sure it'll happen at some point someday. And this Lincoln Center thing seems not to be an issue of fundraising, but again, like this has been a long going problem with the acoustics of Avery Fisher Hall. It needs to be fixed, but the problem is so immense that to tackle it, it's going to be years before they can use the hall again. And they're afraid to give up the hall because they don't want 3 years in another space. They're worried that they'll lose their membership. You know, members are dying off, people are getting old, new young members are not coming in, which is one reason why they're doing the movie series, like showing Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, trying to bring in dumb people, get them to be subscribers, and they're just sort of paralyzed. They know what they need to do, and they're afraid to do it. Saying New York versus LA, look what LA is doing. Geffen made a big donation to some art museum there. You've got the Academy Museum coming up. LA is happening, right?
Yes, indeed, especially when it comes to the arts and the culture. Every year they do, Pacific Standard Time. This year it's LA, which is, you know, how Latino art has influenced art in Los Angeles. And it's a huge success every year, and especially this year, got a huge write-up in the Times. And it's not just in one museum or one location. It's at galleries and museums and spaces throughout Los Angeles each year. It's almost impossible to see all of it. David Geffen, I think he gave some ridiculous amount of money. I think $150 million, maybe even more, to LACMA, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And you have Deborah Borda, who used to be with the LA Phil. Of course, now she's with the New York Philharmonic. So she shows up, kind of looks at this plan and goes, you know what? 3 years instead of two, we're going to need more money. I think I can raise it. Let's put a pause in this plan and see what we can do. Meanwhile, LA is taking off culturally, which I'm kind of glad to see, because when I moved from New York City in the 90s, that was one of my big regrets, was that LA culturally just wasn't nearly as happening as New York was. And now there are tons of young playwrights working in Los Angeles. Why? Because they all work in television, and when they're not, you know, writing for some wonderful series on Netflix, Amazon, or some cable channel, they're writing plays.
Again, the New York Philharmonic says it's not the money. It's that they were told it would be a 2-year break, and now they came back and said, actually, it's going to be at least 3 years where you're out of your home, and that has freaked them out, and that is what made them put a pause on this.
Yeah, no, and I guarantee you it's not 3 years. It's probably four, and if you...
Exactly, yeah.
If you want to...
If they tell you three, you know it's going to be at least three, exactly.
Now, speaking of productions, a small production of the Lin-Manuel Miranda musical In the Heights as part of a cultural festival in Australia was canceled after a worldwide outcry over whitewashing in the cast. People were angered that so many of the parts seemed to be played by white people, with Miranda's character to be portrayed by a guy named Jason Bentley. The show, approved via a community licensing agreement, did not have to match the casting requirements of a full professional production. The cast and creatives voiced their disappointment, but dutifully chided themselves about the issue, though they did point out that they beat the bushes for diverse actors and scoured local hip-hop and salsa studios. Brisbane is the third largest city in Australia, but does not have a big Latino population, and of course, even fewer people of that ethnicity in the local theater world. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal in the sense of, you know, people being a little out of control and knee-jerk slamming something without looking into the issue. First of all, we're talking about, like, I from what I understand, like, you know, five or seven performances. This is not, you know, playing the Australian equivalent of Broadway, nor is it touring the nation. This is just like a little, tiny, little production for a few days of In the Heights. The female lead is Uruguayan. The male lead, Jason Bentley, who people think looks white, is part Samoan. Half the cast, they say, identified with some ancestry other than Australian. And in the city where they're at, less than 1% of the people speak Spanish. There aren't a lot of Latino people. Does that mean they just shouldn't do it? You know, there's a Sydney company called She Shakespeare. It's an all-female Shakespearean company. And they posted their cast for a new production, and people yelled at them for not having enough women of color. I'm like, well, golly, you know, I wish they had more women of color too, I guess, given the local population. And it's a sensitive issue, but they're doing an all-female Shakespeare. You know, like, women don't get enough roles in theater as it is. They're doing an all-female, but like, not enough women of, you know, it's like, dear God, people, you know, put it in perspective a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, in Scandinavia, good luck.
You know? You're never going to do the show. You're going to ship them in from overseas. It's not possible for a 8-performance thing in a local festival. You know, the context of what it is and where it is and how long it's running, you know, should no high school ever do In the Heights if they don't have enough people of color, you know? You should be excited they want to sing this music and celebrate it and are working aggressively to reach out to communities to find people for that. But it doesn't mean you should put a kibosh on all productions ever anywhere, you know.
Netflix is raising its subscription price. Hey, it's not easy paying for billions of dollars in original programming, for Pete's sake. You can find all sorts of plans and levels, depending on video quality and how many people you want to be able to stream a show at the same time. But the most popular service has gone from $10 a month to $11 a month for streaming basic video. You can pay $14 a month and get 4K, and the right to have four people stream at once. Prices last rose exactly 2 years ago on October 2015. Will people decide Netflix isn't worth it? Especially since the service will be losing Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel titles in a year or two? Probably not, but is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. The stock price went up. They were like, great, we're glad you're raising prices. They don't feel like most people will dump it for this price level increase. It's been a couple years. Obviously, they can't do it every year and end up at $50 a month. That will create a problem. But right now, it still seems like a good value, I guess.
Yes, this is the HBO play. You get them hooked on other people's content. You start making your own content. Then you start raising prices. It's, you know, coming straight out of the playbook.
What I found, well, yeah, except it's hard to do. So
correct.
More credit to them. What I found interesting that they barely mentioned in the original statement, DVD sales. You know, they have a DVD subscription where you can still get physical DVDs. Those prices range from $8 to $16, depending on how many discs a month you can get at a time. So like you can get one at a time, that costs you $8 a month. If you want to be able to get two or three, it costs more. And it's $10 to $20 if you want Blu-ray. They still have 3.7 million subscribers in North America getting at least, one part of that plan. If you figure that out, that's probably about $300 million a year. That's not pennies, even for just DVDs.
Yeah, well, part of the problem is that half the movies that I want to see on Netflix are DVD only. So
right, well, it's not their fault. It's that they can't own streaming rights to everything. Yeah, so do you have a plan where you can do both?
Yes, I think they do have a plan where you can do
both.
No,
they do have a plan. I was asking if you have it.
No, I do not.
Oh, yeah. Right, because I wanted to watch Police Squad, and I thought it was on Netflix, but it was DVD only, so we couldn't do it.
The Time Warner Magazine Entertainment Weekly is moving to L.A., surprising me, who thought they were already in L.A., even though I know they first began in New York City.
Really?
Yes, the magazine actually has made its home in New York City since the beginning, but now it's pivoting to L.A. Some 60 staffers have offers to move with the magazine, while a New York office will remain open, albeit with far fewer employees in a smaller space. LA offers easier access to movies and TV sets and the chance for the media company to expand into more video. Their new digs will have a viable studio space, perfect as they pivot from boring old print to podcasts, a Sirius satellite radio channel, a Facebook TV program, and video. I think they want to do video.
When are we going to do video?
Yeah, well, please bite your tongue. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I thought, who knew they were still around? You know, you keep waiting for Entertainment Weekly to die, frankly, because they have no ads in their magazine. Maybe at some point they'll just become a web-only, service, just like Village Voice. I'm happy they're still around. I wrote for them for a number of years. I've always liked them. Maybe their time has passed a little bit as far as a print magazine, but people are still putting money in them. That's pretty good. I'm glad they're still around.
Now, speaking of magazines that I thought were kind of long gone, Premiere Magazine, remember them? Of course you do.
I worked at them as my first job.
Yeah, exactly. So all of a sudden, I think it was Variety or maybe it was The Hollywood Reporter. I actually saw a little thing for Premiere Magazine. I'm like, are they bringing it back? And it was.
What is it?
I don't know. I didn't really look into it.
Okay.
I should have looked into it.
Especially if you're going to bring it up on the show.
Yeah. Premiere. Get the magazine and exclusive online content. Subscribe today. Oh, I guess it was just they're talking about Variety Magazine, and never mind, it's, just it looked like Premiere Magazine, but no, it's just Variety Magazine with the Premiere logo. Okay, well, never mind.
Yeah, the online version ended in 2010.
Of Premiere Magazine.
The print one lasted through 2007, and the online lasted till 2010.
Okay, well, the Killers, to change subjects entirely, are a rock band that has been around for 13 years. They'll have to wait another 12 years before they're eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but they don't have to wait a minute for another milestone, their first number one album on the Billboard charts, in fact. New release, Wonderful Wonderful, did it, and no, it wasn't because of streaming, which is why we're talking about this. The band combined concert tickets with album sales, a ploy similar to other acts like Arcade Fire, LCD Sound System, Katy Perry, on their way to hitting number one. The Killers used the dual offering to move 111,000 albums. That's actual physical albums, along with another 7,000 sale equivalents for streaming.
Which means nobody was streaming it.
Yes, that's
pretty low.
That's a
pretty
good
darn
point.
Low.
And that's that really put them over the top and gave them their first number one spot on the charts for albums. Is this cheating, by the way, or is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I guess if the actual concert ticket costs more if you get the album, then it's not cheating. And if people want to see you in concert and you want to give them an album and pretend that they're paying for it, hey, more power to you. I guess you're getting people to see you in concert. That's where you make your money. And it helps promote the album, which helps promote the show, which is where you make your money. I guess it's a win-win for everyone, but you'd worry a little bit about just, I don't know, are you just reflecting the fact that they're a concert draw or that people actually wanted to hear the new album?
No, I think the story to me was that, you know, this is becoming more and more of a trend, even though it had been done in the past. That
by Prince, among others, who was so innovative in so many areas.
Yeah, where you kind of say, okay, the concert ticket costs, and I'm picking a number here, $50, but get the album with it, and you know it's
55 or it's 62 or
and oh, by the way, VIP with it comes, you know, and you have all of these packages, one of which includes the albums. And of course, what I want to know is, what was the difference between tour tickets and album sales and album sales just alone from, like, say, Amazon?
But people aren't buying music anymore. But if they're actually paying an extra $10 or more to buy the album, I say, great, that sounds legitimate to me.
Yes, I agree. Now, speaking of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they have a new short list of acts eligible for nomination. Among the 19 acts are newcomers and returning hopefuls who haven't received enough votes yet to get in for good. Will Moody Blues strike a blow for prog rock? Can influential artists like Nina Simone, Sister Rosetta, Tharp, Kate Bush, and the Eurythmics up the quotient for women in the hall? And can one great album be enough to get the zombies in the hall? Oh, to heck with who belongs, Michael. Tell us who doesn't belong in the hall. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal for the people involved. They're hoping you'll vote. I voted online. You were able to pick 5 acts out of the 19 to say you felt they should get in the hall. And the top winner gets to have the audience vote, one little lone vote, but a symbolic, important stance to say, we love this act. So we'll have to see. What are your thoughts?
Nina Simone in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, isn't she like
absolutely? Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is about popular music.
Okay,
we've established that long ago. You got rhythm and blues. You got rock people. You got soul. You've got hip hop. You've got folk. You've got country. You know, it's all encompassing. Well, and Nina Simone absolutely deserves to be on there in terms of her artistry.
Yes, true. Okay. Well, then in that case, her Radiohead, sure.
You got 3 more.
I've got 3 more. Dire Straits, Depeche Mode, maybe Bon Jovi next year. Maybe not first year.
Well, your last 3 I absolutely would not pick. I don't think Bon Jovi deserves to be in the hall. Sorry, guys. They're very popular. They're nice, but they're not great. I don't really feel Dire Straits or Depeche Mode belong either, though I'm sure they'll both probably get in. I would pick Kate Bush, the Jay Giles Band, the MC5, the Meters, Radiohead. Nina Simone, Sister Rosetta Tharpe is hugely influential and important. The ones I don't think belong are like Bon Jovi, The Cars, Judas Priest probably deserves to be in. If you're going to talk about heavy metal bands, you know, their album British Steel, that's a classic. And they're a big, if you're into heavy metal at all, that's a very important representative band. And clearly Radiohead belongs in there. But Rufus featuring Chaka Khan, please no. LL Cool J, please God, no. That's ridiculous. He doesn't even have a single good album. He does not belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but he knows so many people, he'll probably get in.
Well, not only that, but his mother said to knock you out.
Yeah, and he's a nice guy. He's a talent. God bless him. But he is not an important musical recording artist. I'm sorry.
Well, certainly I look forward to seeing who does get in, but that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And here is the story that everybody is talking about in Hollywood, and actually it's front page news in numerous newspapers, because it's, you know, Harvey Weinstein, one of the biggest movie moguls to come along in the past 20, 30 years. Well, he may be done.
No, he's not made done. He's been fired. He's gone. He's completely gone. The extended indefinite leave of absence has turned into he's been fired.
Okay,
he's gone for good. No, he's gone. Our headline has changed 17 times. It's changed from big story coming on Harvey Weinstein to, ooh, the story is out. Accusations of sexual harassment. Ooh, decades of payouts to women. Uh-oh, the board is meeting. Uh-oh, he may take a leave of absence. Uh-oh, it's an indefinite leave of absence. Never mind, he's been fired. Four members of the board have quit. His brother is angry. His lawyer has quit. Everybody's angry. Everybody's rushing to say, I didn't know, or I did know.
Right. So let's just back up for just a second.
It's been going at warp speed.
Right. Harvey Weinstein, Bob Weinstein, founded Miramax Films. Pulp Fiction is just one of their many, many movies. They're obviously known for creating independent films that then go on to win Academy Awards. Harvey Weinstein is credited with starting the whole, you know, Oscar campaigning, although it wasn't just him. They left Miramax, started the Weinstein Company, but Harvey Weinstein has always been known as a cantankerous and very difficult individual, and there have been rumors for years that he was kind of a hound, so to speak.
I'd never heard this. All I knew is he was a jerk.
Yes, certainly, and I can testify firsthand. Okay, when we hired people at Film Stew that had worked very closely with him, that were, you know, his second or third in command, the head of distribution underneath Harvey Weinstein at Miramax, who just said, you know, it was impossible to work with the guy and, you know, nobody ever lasted with him. But that was on a professional level. As far as his, you know, being someone who sexually harassed women, that was always one of those things that you could kind of see happening, but you never knew whether the rumors were true.
Right, but now we know that a lot of people around him did know they were true. We know that for decades, they have been making payouts to women, buying off their silence, you know, forcing them into, writing an agreement to not say anything, to avoid lawsuits, and to keep the trouble down because they were making money. His board knew this for many years. They've been making these payouts. Yeah, Disney, they were making payouts. What did they know? When did they know?
Disney didn't make the payouts. It was...
Disney owned Miramax when Miramax reportedly made payouts to people who accused Harvey Weinstein of sexual harassment. What did they know and when did they know it? That's what we'd like to know. The four board members have just quit this board. Four men on the all-male board of the Weinstein Company have quit in anger and disgust, you know, and they've criticized one of his lawyers, Lisa Bloom, who has since quit working with Harvey Weinstein, and, you know, they're discussing. What did they know, and when did they know it? Bob Weinstein says he's shocked and dismayed by what he's heard. Give me a bloody break. He has known for decades, for a long time, that Harvey Weinstein was sexually harassing women, and he did nothing about it because they were making money, and they didn't care. And why, I want to know, is this all coming down now?
Well, here's my take on why it's coming down now. Like Roger Ailes, like Bill Cosby, maybe not Bill O'Reilly, and certainly not Nate Parker. Nate Parker wasn't making anybody money. But frankly, Nate Parker, I'm going to take out of this because this isn't decades of abuse. You know, he's a completely different scenario here. But those are all people who have been doing it for years. So there's more than one victim. There's more than one person to come out and speak out. And they're getting older and they're vulnerable. Somebody, you know, nobody's watching their six as much as they used to be.
Watching their six. Good Lord. Let's not use military terminology. Yes, I think it's a new era. Now people are willing to take these accusations seriously. Before, it would be like, well, I don't know. It's he said, she said, and we weren't in the room. And now they're like, wait a second. We have a pattern of abuse. Multiple people are saying the same thing. We know there is fire here and it's not just smoke. And they're not willing to just say, well, we have to have him convicted in a court. No, no, no. You've got multiple people. You've got him paying out people like Bill O'Reilly did. That means something bad is going on. And I think it is a new era as far as them paying a price for what they did. And people are not. And also, he's more vulnerable. The Weinstein Company has not had a good run the last few years in movies. They're trying to expand into TV. And other than Project Runway, they haven't had a lot of success. So they're a little bit floundering. This may put the company under for good, really, don't you think?
Well, look, if it was Disney, right? Disney, when Walt Disney died, yes, they floundered around a little bit until the 1980s when you had Katzenberg and Eisner show up and they kind of helped revive the company. But it was
floundering just creatively and commercially, not because it had a black eye as being a company founded by somebody who was hateful and evil and sexually harassing women. Now it's like, who wants to do business with the Weinstein Company? It's sort of a tainted brand.
Correct. And that's where I was headed with my comment. Now this, we should point out, this all really stemmed from a bombshell story in the New York Times. Apparently, Michael, you say there's going to be an upcoming story in the New Yorker about this.
Written by Ronan Farrow.
Oh, of all people. I mean, Of all people.
I mean, He's barely written any news stories, and he's doing an in-depth investigative piece for The New Yorker. It helps to be famous.
Yes, it really does, I guess. You know, look, you know, I'd love to know. You said that Miramax was paying people off. I don't know whether it was the companies that were paying people off so much as it was Harvey Weinstein himself paying people off, in which case, okay, if he's paying people off, I get it. Maybe the company isn't necessarily...
He's had multiple lawyers for a year now. He's been fighting off these accusations, threatening lawsuits. He's had a team of lawyers for crisis management on staff and budget for a year. This is not news to people on the Weinstein board. They're not like, what's this? What's happening? They know perfectly well that this problem has been ongoing for many, many years.
Well, certainly what the reason this kind of finally came to light is because a staffer at the Weinstein Company wrote a long memo detailing all of these issues and sent it to, I think it was human resources or you know, the higher ups. And that got leaked eventually. But even that person was paid off.
Well, I don't want to say, don't say paid off, because that implies like they buried their ethics. They spoke up. They tried to call attention to it. They were pressured and pushed and bullied into keeping shutting up and walking away. So, you know, I don't criticize any woman who doesn't feel like they had the ability to come forward and be believed and heard for not doing so, or Rose McGowan for threatening for suing him and then, you know, coming to a settlement. She had the guts to come forward and sue him when people will tear you down and say, oh, you wanted to get your career, you went to his hotel room willingly and all this stuff. You know, she went forward and fought as hard as she could. And, you know, that's what happened. Ashley Judd. She told 2 years ago a story about a big studio executive who pressured her to have sex with her. And I thought, oh, God, how creepy. And she said, you know, I needed to get out of there without insulting them too much because I was young in my career and they could ruin my career. And that's the horrible position they're put in. Was she wrong to not come forward before? No, I don't think so. It's not being bought off. It's like, it's very hard to have people believe you. They don't want to believe you. They don't want to listen. Because she also knew that a lot of people around him knew and didn't care.
Well, think about it. There is a Hollywood stereotype about the casting couch. I mean, that doesn't come from nowhere, okay? However, In this day and age, you know, it was wrong then. It's definitely still wrong now.
Well, it's wrong, but happily now you may pay a price.
Correct.
I mean, Kim Masters talks about how, in a Hollywood Reporter piece, that she's been trying to get this story for 20 years. And she's been, and he knew it. He walked up to her and she was around some pump and said, what do you know about me? And she said, I know this, this, and this. You know, you sexually harass women. You try to force them to have sex with you in exchange for, you know, advancements in their career. And he's like, And he knew she was going for it. And he would introduce her as, she's trying to get me. And she's like, and I still am. And she just couldn't get enough people to go on the record to make a story that could stand up to, you know, the legal scrutiny you need in order to publish that story. So there were people who knew. They were trying to get it out there. There were people who fought him and sued him and won judgments and won money from him. Good for them. That's a sort of tacit admission that he was guilty. And you can say, oh, their silence was bought. But the fact is, once you see he's paid off 5, 6, 8 people over the years, you go, you know what? That's not making a problem go away. He's the problem. And you know that's a pattern of abuse.
Well, and certainly his kind of, you know, apology, admission, and then denial did not help.
I mean, yeah, I feel terrible about what I did, but they're all lying and I'm going to sue.
Right. It made, please, you know, that's, you're so confused. I don't think you understand what's going on here. But, you know, this also stems from a pattern in Hollywood of abusive behavior, whether it's sexual harassment or just bullying, of powerful people in powerful situations, usually producers or studio executives, who just behave badly. Harvey Weinstein was the poster child for this. I mean,
I always thought of Scott Rudin.
Scott Rudin, also, same exact thing.
Joel Silver. Yeah.
And I can tell you personal stories about every single one of those people and others where I was either the brunt of it, where, you know, it was, and it's not personal, they do it to everybody, or where I witnessed it firsthand. And you know what? I don't know whether they're still like that. I can't speak to Joel Silver or Scott Rudin or even Harvey Weinstein, although maybe I can now. But certainly in, you know, my experiences with those people, at, you know, even up to 10 years ago, was not kind. They were not very nice.
Right. And I've always thought, why the hell would you ever go work for them? I mean, it's like you advance your career, you put yourself in a position to get abused. I understand it's a great opportunity, but I would never have gone. I'm not criticizing the people who were abused by them as the victim, but it's like, I just wouldn't go within a room with them. I don't want to be near them. They're hateful people.
I've been offered jobs with both Joel Silver and Scott Rudin in the past. And this was like, 18 years ago. And I turned them down specifically because of that. I thought, you know what? Yes, it could be a nice little, launch pad, but no, life is too short.
Yeah, so Hollywood has a lot more to do than saying, well, if I see him whip out his penis and masturbate, like the horrible things Harvey Weinstein was accused of doing, or not accused, but, we know he's guilty of, essentially. It doesn't have to go that far. Just someone should not behave like a complete jerk. That should not be acceptable just because they're making you money. And you criticize the defense team and the crisis management people around him, and they've gotten sort of bad grades for how this has been dealt with. And people will say, well, if your client's not willing to listen to you, there's nothing you can do, right? If Harvey's not willing to understand that the crisis is his behavior, not the fact that people are accusing him of it or speaking out about it, but the fact of what he's doing. If he doesn't acknowledge that, there's not a lot you can do to make him behave well. But you know what? And they say, well, don't blame them because he's just not taking their advice. Yeah, but they've sat around him for a year cashing his check. They know what he's doing. They know he's not taking steps to stop. And they enable him and are setting up a defense of him. I mean, it's not a court of law when you're doing crisis management. Everybody deserves legal defense. But, like Gloria Allred says, I don't take cases for people who are accused of sexual harassment. I take cases of people who are, accusing others of sexually harassing them.
Well, and the irony is Lisa Bloom, Weinstein's attorney, is the daughter of Gloria Allred.
Right. And she got dissed by the board and her mother and really screwed up and has done her reputation no good, certainly with this whole fiasco, which is what it is, refused to acknowledge the conflict of interest. She's like, there's no conflict of interest just because they're developing my Trayvon Martin book into a miniseries and I'm representing Harvey in this sexual, what conflict? So, but I don't want to make it about her as such because, she's paid enough of a price already. And the real villain here is Harvey Weinstein.
Well, and okay, you asked whether, the Weinstein Company can continue. Brooks Barnes of the New York Times, he states that, a couple things. First off, as you mentioned, the company was kind of struggling on the movie front anyway. And they have a number of competitors now for all those acquisitions that they do at the Sundance Film Festival and other film festivals. Netflix, Amazon, they kind of are the big players now as opposed to the Weinstein Company. They have Annapurna as well. So there are other players, A24 coming to, I think they won for Moonlight, the best picture for Moonlight last year. So they weren't the only game in town. So, again, Harvey Weinstein and the Weinstein Company was in a weaker position. And this is why it's a little bit more understandable why this can happen right now.
Yes. They were vulnerable. There was blood in the water. And people are willing to listen, more importantly. People are willing to take seriously these accusations because there isn't a lot to be gained by making false accusations. That's what happens in movies. False accusations of rape. False. It's like, usually you get put through the ringer. It's not really a winning strategy for anybody. People don't run around doing a lot of false accusations, except in Hollywood movies. And maybe that's why they love them so much, because it just justifies their own behavior.
Well, and when you behave like a jerk for, 2 to 3 decades and you have a string of former employees who just, don't like you, there's nobody there to defend you.
Mm-hmm. And it's nice to know that it's not just the black man. With Bill Cosby and Nate Parker, you had a sense of, why are they paying the price? However awful what they were doing was, how come it's always about? You're like, no, Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, Nate Parker. Perhaps it's just the behavior of men who abuse their power that is paying the price here. And the one thing that really irked me was Lisa Bloom saying, well, he's an old dinosaur. It's learning new. And Harvey's like, well, back in the 60s, who knew? It's like, give me a break.
You know what? I did see Don Draper doing what you've been accused of doing.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I forget all the things he did. So, I mean, there were certainly instances of sexual harassment at the office of the ad agency they worked at.
Good point.
But my point is, we still knew that was wrong in the 50s. That wasn't news. You can read a Victorian novel where the bad guy threatens a woman and says, I'll fire your husband or I'll destroy your home or whatever. You have to sleep with me. And he pressures her into having sex with him. And we knew that was the bad guy. Even in the 1800s, we knew you shouldn't force and harass people into having sex with you because you have power over them. So this is not something we learned in the 90s. So give me a break.
Well, now, speaking of people behaving badly, and that kind of wraps up our Inside Baseball segment. It moves us along into listener email, where we have, again, this is a comment left on my personal Google Plus, account there on a story that I posted from a few weeks back about Springsteen tickets being so costly and Taylor Swift tickets being so expensive. Richard Horgan, who is the co-editor of Fishbowl over at Adweek, you know, Fishbowl being kind of a media blog that watches the media, he wrote, "I was chatting with someone who attended the first preview performance of Springsteen on Broadway, which happened October 2nd, and was amazed to learn there is no policy banning the use of cell phones. He said ushers tried to control, but that there was the usual annoying overuse right down to a guy in his row, a guy sitting in his friend's row. One idea occurred to me is for Springsteen to select on a rotating basis one song during each night's performance as the one where folks are encouraged, if they want to pull out the cell phone and film it. Make it a part of the show. I guess given how much people are paying here, he couldn't demand they check their phones at the door. And Michael, as you know, we both know, $700 a ticket, $850 a ticket is the top price."
Well, you know, obviously Broadway never has people check their phones. I'm a little surprised at this, that they're not trying to stop people from doing that, because it's not a concert. It's an actual performance where he's talking, and I can't believe that people are holding their phones up during the entire show and taping stuff. That blows my mind. I have not heard this. I've read chat boards about the early previews and haven't heard anyone mention this one way or another. Two things I would say. One, I agree with you, Richard, completely. I've made the same suggestion myself for rock concerts. I've said, hey, why not say, all right, hey, it's the first song. Everybody play. You want to show your friends you're here? Videotape it now. All right, yeah, we do. This is the song you can all do. And then after that, put it the hell away and just watch the show, because I'm sick of watching you hold your phone up. So I think that's a great idea for rock concerts. I think people should do that if they want to. But, you know, a Broadway show, that's just bizarre. My God. And they can't rotate the song, because then you'd have the whole show posted online in 5 minutes. And I'm sure they're taping it for HBO or Netflix or Amazon or whoever it might be that wins the lottery of getting to show this concert on their streaming service.
Well, I'd like to thank Richard for making the comment. And again, you're always welcome to write into dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or call us 888-567-SAND. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You usually can find our show. And if you can't find our show, please write to us. Let us know, and we'll kind of work on getting it posted. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Again, showbizsandbox.com is our website. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's bruce.com. I'm not going to see you. I can't get tickets to Bruce Springsteen.
Well, we had tickets.
And if you've got tickets, send them.
Exactly. Now, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to thehuffingtonpost.com, or, you know, head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to find out what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.